Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Hyundai, supporting the drive to keep our distance. chse.ie for more. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Hyundai, supporting the drive to keep our distance. chse.ie for more.
Good morning and you're very welcome to the show, and hope you're all in good form today. If you're not in good form, do you know what is probably going on with you? I read about something yesterday called third quarter phenomenon. So if you're in a mission, it's a fact apparently that when the mission is halfway done and you're heading into the second half of the mission, you feel you've done a lot already, but the end is still too far away and there is a lull in morale always at this point. So don't worry, it's entirely natural. And I know that there are a lot of people this weekend as well missing what should have been communion and confirmation days. And I think it's focused again for a lot of people that they can't see relatives and can't see grandparents and everything else. But look, we try and keep it lively for the next couple of hours and distract you and indeed entertain and inform as well. Now, the papers today, the Irish Mail on Sunday, it sounds like there's a bit of a third quarter phenomenon going on in the cabinet. According to the Mail, they have cabinet in turmoil. Government is afraid to reject civil servant advice. Concerns over tough public health measures ignored. Ministers fear Ireland is turning into a police state. One minister said this. He said it's turning into a police state. There is a fear in government that too much power has been ceded by politicians to senior civil servants. Cabinet ministers told the Mail on Sunday that they fear making decisions that would overrule advice from officials because of the possible effect on their political reputations and careers. So I think that is possibly true, that there are certainly some people in cabinet who would like to come out stronger to open up the economy quicker, but then they are afraid that they'd be caught on the wrong side of some kind of a surge. There's an interesting, and that story continues inside, there's an interesting little outlining of the governance structure for the COVID-19 national response. So the NPHET reports to the senior officials group, which is effectively the group of powerful civil servants who come forward with ideas. And then they report to the cabinet subcommittee. So there seems to be a question here that some people, one minister saying the political system comes under an enormous amount of scrutiny, and rightly so. But these people, by which I think he means the senior officials group, pulling all the levers are coming under no scrutiny. It's unbelievable. You can't get the minutes out of an SOG meeting because it's protected by cabinet committee rules. But a spokesman for the Department of Taoiseach said that the SOG has no decision-making powers. They also have a poll today from Ireland Thinks in the Mail, and according to this opinion poll, Fine Gael enjoying the rally round the flag effect, presumably, are up 15 points to 36%. Sinn Féin are up 2 points to 27%. Fianna Fáil are down 6 to 16%. Green Party down 1 to 6%. The Labour Party 4% unchanged, Sock Dems 3% unchanged, and Solidarity People Before Profit 2% unchanged, and Independents 6% down 9%. That's according to that poll in the Mail. The Sunday Times, Donoghue to cut 350 COVID-19 payout in June. But what that actually is that they will, I think, look at cutting it for some of those people who were earning less than €350 a week before COVID-19 struck. And we did learn that 38% of those on the pandemic unemployment payment, that's 222,000 people, were taking home more on the benefit than they were when they were working. And it also says in this story that the government is going to renew discussions next week on whether to make self-isolation mandatory for international travellers to Ireland after ministers raised concerns about its impact on food supply chains, business, and the movement of airline and medical personnel. Speaking of airlines, so Michael O'Leary, the chief executive of Ryanair, said that the Ryanair planes will not be disinfected after every flight, because we know that part of Ryanair's business model is turning around the planes very fast. You kind of, in the normal course of events, you have to clean your own area really when you get on the plane. Instead, they'd be cleaned once daily with chemicals, which he claims provide protection for 24 hours. And of course, the Sunday Times has the story that has, I think it's fair to say, has electrified the UK. And this is the story about Dominic Cummings breaking lockdown. Boris Johnson saying he will not have him thrown to the dogs. And of course, new allegations came out last night that Dominic Cummings, they're being denied today, I understand, that Dominic Cummings actually went back up to Durham a second time. And also that he did a bit of sightseeing when he was there the first time, allegedly self-isolating and had to go there because of his family and everything. But they claimed he went to a local beauty spot one day. The Business Post. Nursing homes told to withhold information on COVID-19 outbreaks. So nursing homes were told not to tell residents and family of the extent of COVID-19 outbreaks by their representative group. So NHI circulated a memo to its members, and the memo said the nursing home has been instructed at this time by NPHET to not provide such updates relating to the total number of suspected confirmed cases identified in the nursing home. NPHET denied it gave any such instructions. HICWA says that nursing homes were encouraged to communicate clearly and sensitively, but were not obligated is the word here, to inform residents or the families of residents who lack full decision-making capacity about the extent or severity of outbreaks. If you were a family and you had a member of your family in a nursing home and you were trying to ascertain, was there COVID in there? And we've seen people like this come out and you were not being told. You could imagine you could be quite annoyed. And the Post also has insurers accepted some businesses had a strong case in private meeting. That was a private meeting with Pascal Donoghue. The situation seems to be that most insurance policies for business continuance would not be paid out on, but that the insurance companies are suggesting there are some that would be, and they'd like to focus the discussion on them. The Sunday Independent leads with, they have a big interview inside with Mary Lou MacDonald, and it is a very interesting interview with Hugh O'Connell. So their lead story is some stuff from that interview. Mary Lou MacDonald has said the IRA campaign was justified. There's every chance she would have taken up arms during the Troubles. He says that MacDonald set out a staunch and unwavering defence of the IRA's campaign of violence and her attendance at events, honouring those who perpetrated atrocities. I wish it hadn't happened, but it was a justified campaign, she said. She also revealed that Prince Charles actually got onto her when she was recovering from COVID-19, among other people, and Leo Varadkar did not. The Sunday World has a story about a cab search, and they also have a story inside saying that people will be delighted to hear this now. RTÉ have been given the green light to shoot a new series of First Dates Ireland, but romantic hopefuls will be banned from touching, kissing, and will have to keep 2 metres away from each other. Which I think, in fairness, a lot of the people on First Dates did anyway. It was no Love Island for sure. The Sun on Sunday, blood of 50 on cartel hands, and they are reminding people that the Kinahan's cartel reign of terror across Europe has led to the killing of over 50 people, according to The Sun, because obviously Daniel Kinahan has been trying to kind of segue into being a legitimate businessman and has been trying to clear his name. There's been a crazy sounding documentary made about how the shootings in the hotel, name escapes me, in the Regency Hotel, thank you, Christine, were actually a plot by Fine Gael, and crazy stuff. And finally, the Irish Sunday Mirror, risk your lives for 10.80 an hour, right? Hospital cleaners have hit out at a U-turn over 40 cent an hour pay rise, with one fuming, we are risking our lives for 10.80 an hour. And that would puts a lot of things in perspective for, I'd say, a lot of people who are comfortably working from home and everything else. The hospital cleaners are frontline workers in the absolute sense of the word, and they are getting 10.80 an hour for going into cleaning up those rooms after people have been in there with the virus and everything else. Our panel today: Anthony Staines is from the School of Nursing in DCU. Christina Finn is political correspondent with the Journal.ie. Michael O'Keefe is a consultant ophthalmologist. And Professor Sheila Killian joins us from the Limerick studio, and she is from the Kemi Business School in the University of Limerick. Good morning, everybody, and you're all very welcome.
Good morning.
Now, there is a story on page 4 of the Sunday Times that I know a few of you have picked out. Anthony Staines, we'll start with you on this story. It's supermarket staff avoid virus, and this is a story by Mark Tice. So Lidl of 5,200 staff, 14 of them have tested positive. Aldi out of 4,000 staff, 10 of them have tested positive. And Tesco and Dunnes didn't give numbers, but they said a small amount. What do you make of this story?
Well, I think it's good news. This is a group of people who are very exposed to the general public because what they're doing is essential work. So there's a lot of people coming in and out of supermarkets. The public have responded really well to the social distancing rules. We've seen people queuing outside Tesco's. We've seen one-way systems in the supermarkets. And people seem to be adhering to that. And it appears to be working.
Christina Finn, do you think there's social distancing successfully going on in supermarkets most of the time?
From what I've witnessed, I would say yes. Now, the odd time you'd have someone coming up behind you at the tills that perhaps people have seen tell them to keep their distance. But I think this story will probably be latched on to by other retailers and other large retailers who perhaps will make the argument that why aren't they open if supermarkets are seeing such
and
low...
And indeed, we spoke to some of them yesterday.
Exactly, yes. Particularly homeware stores who have really, I suppose, come up against it in the last week where they thought they were going to be able to open only for the government to say that they mistakenly put that on the roadmap. You know, large retailers, I think, will look at some of those numbers. I think 10 and 11 people within Aldi and Lidl of a workforce of nearly 10,000 people would be quite encouraging, I think, to retailers that they would be able to operate under similar circumstances.
Michael O'Keefe, does this change everything in a way? Because these people have not been wearing PPE, not that I've noticed. They're not wearing masks. They're working away there in quite close confines a lot of the time. And we discovered that the virus is virtually non-existent in these settings.
Well, it probably puts into perspective the science of this thing. We don't know much of what we're doing. We don't know whether it works or not. We hope it does. And so, I mean, all these people have been doing, they've been washing their hands, keeping their distance. So they've been doing nothing more spectacular. And they've been, as you said, not wearing masks. And it certainly... I think raises what Christine said is that we got to open up these other shops to people. I think it's unfair for these people to be locked down. And now we've more evidence to suggest that there's no reason why they shouldn't be open.
Sheila Killian, what do you make of this?
Well, I agree with everyone. It's very encouraging. And I think there's a lot to be learned from these sectors. I have seen supermarket workers wearing masks, mind you, in recent weeks. And also they're fairly well protected with perspex at the tills and so on. But I think it does show a model of how things can go forward. It'd be a good idea to look at their practices. So, for instance, in a very basic thing, supermarket trolleys are wiped down all the time. That's a bit different to saying you'll disinfect the planes once a day. You know, so I think some of the good practices do need to carry over to other sectors.
Is there a lesson here as well, Christina, about if you take that in conjunction with the story on the front of the Mail, risk your lives for 10.80 an hour, is it telling us something about... The workers that are out there, a lot of them on low pay, but expected to go out there and be front-facing and deal the public while a lot of other people are comfortably working away at home and possibly saying, I don't know, we'll come back into the office.
Yeah, I think that's this whole situation has really given people an appreciation for the different cohorts in the workforce that, you know, largely go unthanked for their work from day to day, be it supermarket, people, cleaners, people out, you know, cleaning the streets and all the rest. But I do have concerns sometimes about the narrative on the flip side of this coming out about, you know, the scammers of the COVID-19 payment and almost looking towards lower paid workers, that there's some sort of untoward going on in terms of them trying to get more money than they are worth. So I do think there's definitely two sort of narratives coming out of this pandemic in terms of obviously looking at those workers and giving them thanks for actually going out in the front line while a lot of us are safely sitting at home. But also I think there is a narrative running alongside that in terms of, you know, looking at the payment that we do give a lot of these workers.
Okay, Anthony Staines, would you agree with Michael O'Keefe that this is a signal that it's time to open up the economy?
I think the other side for this is that we know this is a disease which affects poorer people much more severely than wealthier people. Now, those data haven't been collected for Ireland, But for every country in Europe that they have been looked at, poorer people are at much higher risk. And that may be related to crowding in accommodation. It may be related to other things. So this is a group of low-paid staff who are at significant risk because of the jobs they do. And in some places,
but they're not getting the virus.
In some places, numbers. They're not. In other places, they are. So if we look at the meat factories, for example, they've been a disaster. And there's a story in one of the papers where there's a row between the Health and Safety Authority and the HSE, each of whom is ducking responsibility for regulating these workplaces. So the HSA is saying, this is a public health matter. It's nothing to do with occupational health and safety. It's nothing to do with us. And HSE is saying, well, this is workplaces. We don't do workplaces. You do workplaces. But while they're having this fight, nothing is happening. So it's only this week that HSA inspectors have started going into the meat factories. And that's extraordinary because we've known for, I think, 10 weeks from the United States that meat factories were major sources of infection in the community. And we've known for about 6 weeks that the meat factories were a major source of infection in our own community. But nobody has stirred their stumps to actually go and look after the interests of those workers. So there is a narrative
so
which
have
says...
have we missed, Anthony, have we missed the places where the major outbreaks are occurring? We missed the nursing homes. And we miss the meat factories. And care homes and meat factories seem to be central to driving on the virus in Ireland.
Yeah, they are places we missed. Now, there's lots of places we didn't miss. So there's lots of places where probably we hadn't done what we did. They would now be driving the epidemic. Those are certainly two places we missed. Because the meat factories were an essential work. So the meat industry kept going. And care homes, we've had a policy of building bigger and bigger and bigger care homes, largely financed by tax incentives. So we've gone from building large institutions for unmarried mothers, large institutions for wayward children, large institutions for people with disabilities, all of which we're now getting rid of. And we're now building large institutions for the frail elderly.
And
there's
people
a risk
in direct
to that.
Provision also.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
But I do think what perhaps are in common between the meat firms and the nursing homes is, as you said, there did seem to be a gap between who was looking after these sectors. So with the nursing homes, we have public and private. And, you know, the public at the beginning were under the remit of government who were, you know, perhaps supplying PPE. And it was sort of the private nursing homes who were calling out saying that they actually needed more supplies and the state had to step in to help fund that. And the same, I suppose, with the meat factories is we have, as you said, two different firms saying, well, we're not exactly over them. We're not exactly in charge of making inspections on them. But I do think the nursing homes is definitely something that is going to play on and play on. We had Fergus O'Dowd and the Dáil raising reports from HICWA back in 2018 about the failure of infection control, even before we had this pandemic. So we're almost saying that the nursing homes were going in with their hands tied behind their back in terms of this. They were coming into a war with, you know, little ammunition, and they were having firing squads coming over the hill at them because we weren't inspecting and giving the proper resources to nursing homes before even this came about.
So Michael, to your point about loosening the rules is one thing, but we obviously there's going to be a lot of oversight, inspection, regulation of everything, isn't there?
Right,
I think I heard Ingrid say on the news that there are 62 HSA inspectors for workplaces, I think something in the region of between 60 and 70, which doesn't strike you as a lot
Going back to the thing about the meat factories. The meat factories, the problem is that a lot of the people are from overseas and they live in very poor conditions. So they're living on top of each other. And this is the exact same as we've seen in New York, where they got out of hand, where you have all these people living on top of each other, unaccounted for. And so I think that's part of the problem. The other thing, I'm not sure that you can, most conditions, I suppose, affect poorer people. It's the nature of the diseases. Not everything. Cancer is one of the examples where you, no matter how rich or poor you are, you get it. But the point is, obese people get this. Black patients have been more common and more likely to get it. People who have other conditions. So it's not just strictly poor people that have been getting this viral infection. There's been a whole lot of other problems. In the UK, for example, three of the doctors were from overseas who died. And they're not exactly poor people, you know. So I think that's the other thing. I think, Brendan, is that in my view, when the treatment becomes worse than the disease itself, or when parts of the treatment as a doctor become, then you've got to look at them. You've got to say, look, and the disease itself is where this country's in lockdown. 25% of the population unemployed, 30 billion in debt. Small businesses can't open, people in desperate states. And I think we've now got to look at the fact that we've got to start opening the economy. And I think we can do it safely.
Can I challenge you on two things, Michael? It's commonly thought that the meat industry in Ireland is occupied by unregulated foreign workers. That's not true. 80% of the people who work in the meat industry in Ireland were born in Ireland. 20% are people who come from other countries and work here. So there's a myth about the meat industry which needs to be dealt with. The second point is the economic argument. There is an economic cost to what we're doing, and I absolutely agree. We need to look at all the measures that we do. We need to review them, and we need to review them constantly. But the economic work that's been done shows that stopping the spread of this disease is much cheaper than allowing it to run its course. We reckon at the moment maybe 5% of the Irish population have been infected. Now, we don't know, because the antibodies testing hasn't been done in Ireland, but in other countries it has. That's 95% of the population still at risk. So we're not just talking about a second wave. We're talking about a third wave and a fourth wave and a fifth wave. And we're talking about keeping up. Supposing we do decide to go to 1 metre social distancing, because there's nothing magic about 2 metres. There's nothing magic about 1 metre. But even if we do that, the economic impact of that on schools, the economic impact of that on childcare, the economic impact of that on workspaces, the economic impact of that on the restaurant trade and the pub trade is enormous. I agree a restaurant may be totally unviable with 10 customers, but it's not an awful lot more viable with 25 customers.
So what the alternative you're suggesting is that we eliminate this completely, Anthony?
What I'm suggesting now is we need to have a serious conversation. Do we want to try to get rid of this, to stop the virus circulating in our communities? And that's going to cost some money.
Now, we've been told, the CMO has said it is, I think, eliminated, was extinguished in the community in general. That's not gone far enough for you? You think we need to go much further?
As long as we have a large number of cases, we had, I think, 88 cases yesterday, 100 cases the day before that. As long as we have that number of cases, yeah, it's not under control.
Okay.
Now, I know we're looking at infections that occurred maybe 3 days ago to 10 days ago. And I suggest we start a conversation about what we should be doing and see what happens over the next week to 10 days. But my instinct and the evidence of other epidemics is that if we release the lockdown too quickly, we will be living with this virus for a very long time.
Are we not told by the WHO and all these people that we do need to learn to live with this virus? Do you think we could actually completely eliminate this virus in Ireland and keep it eliminated?
We could eliminate it at the point at which it ceases to be a serious problem. Okay. So South Korea is an example. They've had one major outbreak of the virus in the last month. They managed to control that outbreak very quickly. There was no secondary spread from the initial outbreak. And that was a nuisance. But largely the South Korean economy is back. Largely the Chinese economy is back. Largely the Austrian economy is back. And Austria is already talking about allowing people to travel from other countries. So if we can get ourselves into the same position as Austria, as Greece, as Iceland, then the economic opportunities for us as a small open economy. There's no virus circulating in Ireland. When you leave Ireland, you don't have to spend 14 days in quarantine somewhere else. It opens up, it reduces our costs dramatically, and it opens up opportunities.
And just one other question for you. Are we not cutting ourselves off from, if the virus is circulating in our major trading partners and our tourism partners and everything, are we not cutting ourselves off from them by being almost too pure then?
They're all cutting themselves off. Britain has barred foreign travel except from Ireland. all across Europe, there are barriers to travel which didn't exist.
Barriers which are coming down fairly rapidly.
No, barriers which are actually going up. If you look at what's happening across the European Union, there's more barriers in place now than there were a month ago. So, I mean, our tourism is not going to come back to normal this year. But our best bet at a long-term normality is showing leadership in driving out this virus.
Sheila Killian, what do you make of that?
I think that's a very sensible kind of a line because, like, you can't even post a letter to New Zealand. That's how closed off some of the more successful countries are. And I think what businesses need and what financiers and banks need to give credit to business is some element of security. So we want pubs and restaurants and everybody to open so that they can employ the people who've lost their jobs. We want them to open with a reasonable expectation that they're not going to have to close down again in 2 months' time. So I think we do need to open up the economy, but we do need to do it very cautiously. And we need to take into account the behavioural impact of guidelines as well. So there's 1 metre, 2 metre distance.
Yeah.
No Irish person really knows what 2 metres looks like, particularly not when you see
We do
talking.
Know. There are enough signs everywhere
there
now
signs
that we
everywhere,
know at this stage.
People are mostly standing about a metre and a half away from each other chatting in public places, which is grand. But if you cut it down to a metre, people will probably be a little closer. The behavioural stuff matters. Like maybe masks might help. I think the communication on masks was a little bungled and maybe that would help to open things up. But I do think we need to be careful about the... And I think there are lessons to be learned from the supermarkets. They've done things successfully. That doesn't mean you can just automatically open without looking closely at the good things they did. Like in meat factories, for instance, then it's very noisy and people shout and that projects more droplets from what I can see. So there are a lot of businesses that would need to change their practices a little in other ways apart from just the distancing. And then hopefully we could open up properly again.
And Sheila, in terms of your expertise as accountancy and tax, how long more do you think that A, business and B, the public finances could bear the lockdown?
Oh, you see, at the moment it's like technically unbearable in that we're obviously spending far more than we're bringing in. It's a very costly thing for government because we lose all the sources of tax, you know, income tax, corporation tax, VAT, because people aren't spending and so on, while spending far more on supporting people. So the thing is unviable financially, which is where I think we do need a certain amount of social solidarity, both within the country to avoid a kind of a spike in populism, but also across Europe, because there's a good article in one of the papers where they're talking about the fact we will need we'll need the money from Europe. We're definitely, it's in the page 20 of the Indo. They're saying we're going to need the EU bailout. So we, and the EU bailout is essentially, the proposal is 500 billion to be borrowed by the EU and distributed to the countries that need it, not to be repaid. So that kind of thing can make this bearable, and that kind of thing is viable as long as we play our part in keeping the levels low and, as Anthony says, get to the situation where we can open up to particular countries.
Christina, you wanted to come in there.
I just think that the questions that are being raised, particularly around Leinster House between officials and I think probably some proportion of the public, is the question needs to be asked about balance and proportionality with all of this. And I think there's...
Would you, from what you're hearing, would you back up what the front page of the Mail is saying there, that there's now a lot of tension between politicians and the public health officials?
I think there definitely has been for a long time. I think Mark Paul's article in the Irish Times on Friday, and I know you spoke to him yesterday, represents some, if not many, of the voices at government level at the moment in terms of what we're facing. There's a real concern about tribunals down the line in terms of if somebody says something or they push ahead with something and it turns out to be the wrong decision, that ultimately someone will be held accountable for that. But I think the message coming out is that they're moving in real time here and making decisions as they go. But I think there is a real concern from ministers and officials that the blithe acceptance of some of the recommendations coming forward from the National Public Health Emergency is going to paralyse our economy, and particularly with this new one with the travel issue at the moment. So on Friday, the Cabinet agreed that the form that you have to fill out is mandatory, and you get penalties and fines and
jail. 6 months in jail for the form.
Exactly.
But it seems to be not illegal not to actually isolate yourself.
But that's going to be, I was speaking to some ministers yesterday, and they said keep an eye on this next week, because that will be the real flashpoint. In terms of a step too far. The form was one thing.
That might be when some of them might actually come out.
Yeah, because the form was one thing. If you're talking about designated facilities, that was recommended from Tony Holohan in terms of possible passengers coming over to Ireland to self-isolating them, that is seen as I think it was said in the Mail.
Just to be clear, do you think that next week we could see public disagreement between between politicians and NPHET?
I think there could be discussions at Cabinet, and they're already happening, but I don't think that needs to be grasped on so much. And there's often in the big headlines of a minister raised the 1 metre against the 2 metre, and suddenly that's a big argy-bargy at Cabinet. Like, I would prefer to see, and I think most people would prefer to see, dissenting voices and questions being raised. There's nothing wrong with questioning public health advice and decision-making process of the government. So I think most people would welcome that. And I think if there is going to be a discussion around that, I think it's representing some of the voices that are out there. Obviously, there's some people that believe we need to stringently stick to this and go for a longer lockdown. But there's equally a lot of people who are saying that this pace is far too slow.
Okay, Anthony Staines, Christina Finn, Michael O'Keefe and Professor Sheila Killian still with us. We'll talk to you in just after this quick break.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.
Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Hyundai, supporting the drive to keep our distance. chse.ie for more.
Welcome back. Anthony Staines, Christina Finn, Michael O'Keefe and Sheila Killian, our panel, still with us. Two sides of the supermarket thing. John in West Cork says there's a world outside big cities. Social distancing not working in many local supermarkets except at tills. Aisles are danger zones between customers, shelf stackers and their stacking trolleys. There is no one to complain to. Masks should be mandatory and policed. And then another texter says, I work in a large Super Value. We've had no cases. Customers are very aware. We have loads of gloves, wash in, wash out facility, hand sanitizer for all, social distancing everywhere, door control with security guards with clickers, feel quite safe. There's also a text here from Caroline Sheehan, I think, Michael O'Keefe. Can you please ask Dr. O'Keefe why he's moved his practice to Kildare from the Mater Private? Now, the last time you were in here, you were the first private consultant to break cover, actually, yeah, and say that you weren't going along with this and that it was unfair on you guys and that you were letting down all your private patients, the deal with the private hospitals. How has the story spun out since for you?
How has the story spun out, Brendan, is that unilaterally my practice was pulled from me with about a phone call.
And when then, you say, let's be careful here, explain that.
Oh, in the sense that I was told that I couldn't see my private patients for consultation, or I couldn't do any surgeries anymore for the duration of the time the hospital was being nationalised. And then I queried, look, I have patients that are urgent and need to be treated. And I was on your show on the Sunday and I made an issue of it. And by the Tuesday, then I was able to treat my emergencies, because obviously the weight of public opinion and political opinion carried a day. And so since then, I've only been able to treat patients on a pro bono basis, and all the urgent or patients that need to be seen. And so this is going to go, and this was, I was offered, as a NEA contract. Now, NEA contract, the three contracts were consulted, NEA contract, a B contract, and a C contract. And the A contract would be the totally wrong one for private doctors. If you were a doctor with 2,000 private patients and you're offered an A contract, the first thing it says, you can't treat any more private patients. You can't do private patients at all. So this was quite crazy to offer people a contract like that. And you would have to wonder whether it was an ideologically driven contract or whether it was anything really practical. And if they'd offered doctors a C contract where you could still treat your private patients and see and do public patients, then that would have been acceptable. So I'm now in the situation where I have 3 months nearly, and this could go on for 5 months. And if some people have their way, it might go on forever. And therefore, I have to move my practice, you know, where I can make a living again, where I can see my private patients, where I can do laser surgery, which I do a lot of, where I can see children. And I've now been offered a place down in Kildare, owned by a private doctor, who has set up a very, very good research place and a place that I can work and I can treat patients. And that's where I'm moving next week.
And Michael, you were involved with the public health service in this country for how long?
26 years.
Okay, and now this is your the final kind of...
Yeah, well then I was forced to retire, even though I did a year extra for nothing for them. And then I ended up in a private practice, and I've always had a private practice, and I don't have any ideological problems with private or public practice. I've done both of them. And therefore, I have a big private practice, mainly a laser practice. I see an awful lot of children, and I want to keep that going. And I think what has been inherently done here has been totally unfair. I think these 600 private consultants have been thrown under the bus. They've actually been, because they're doctors and because they're treating private patients, nobody gives a care outside. You know, that's what the impression I get. And they've been completely unfairly treated.
That's a very sour ending for you after a lifetime in the
matter private. It's a very sour ending. I'd hoped I'd finished there, and I've had good memories of the place. Not in recent times, because a lot of these private hospitals have become very commercial, and I've been very upset by some of the advertising they go on. These hospitals now, they've marketing people, and all these sort of people have moved in, and they create all these ads and things which don't make any sense, and they create false expectations amongst patients who then patients get the idea that as a doctor can cure everybody.
Okay, let's not accuse any private hospitals of false advertising now. I mean,
I don't say false, Brendan. I say unacceptable advertising to me.
Okay. This would have happened anyway with Sláintecare, wouldn't it?
No. Sláintecare would be, the difference with Sláintecare would be that the public hospitals would become totally for public patients, which I think is a good idea. I absolutely agree with it. Look, I've seen people come to me, their relatives scrape up money to do their cataracts, the kids come because they can't, and I think that's appalling because they can't get in because for years I've given out about the problem, I've been ineffective, badly run, all these things I've said. And so therefore now, and the private hospitals then would be totally private, and you'd be a consultant where you'd make your option whether you'd be private or public, and I think that's what should happen. But what's happening now is you've slowed to care in reverse. I could go to the public hospital over there and I could do my cases and I could charge for them. If they were health insurance, I could...
And indeed, I know somebody who was in, got public health care recently, and they were asked to sign the VHI thing, and they said, sure, which, you know, I might as well, I'm paying my VHI anyway.
Yeah.
So the public hospitals are still getting money from private health insurers.
We have slanted care in reverse. It's absolutely ludicrous.
Anthony Staines, what do you make of that? Was the whole thing a mess?
Oh, yeah, it's an extraordinary mess. We've now got a situation where we're paying a lot of money for the private hospitals and they're not being used. The occupancy rates that are being reported in the press are frighteningly low. There was a reason.
We need this capacity, apparently. We need it to sit empty until we need it, do we, for a second surge?
No, that's nonsense. The reason for taking them on in the first place was that we didn't know how bad things are going to get. That was the right choice. But when it became clear that things were not going to be nearly as bad as our worst fears, and our worst fears were, you know, Northern Italy. I have a lot of Italian colleagues. I know a lot of people in Lombardy. And what happened there would frighten anyone. And that we were afraid that would happen here, but it didn't. So the logical thing to do with the private hospitals would have been to do lots and lots and lots and lots of elective surgery on all comers, because that's what the private hospitals are set up for, is, you know, cranking through routine cases, at sometimes very technically advanced routine cases, at high speed. But we didn't do that. And I don't care really how the consultants get paid. I think consultants should get paid. I don't think that's unreasonable. I think the model of private care we have at the moment is unsustainable, but that's a whole other discussion. But the way we've used the private hospitals is embarrassing.
Okay, Michael texts here, not all hugely sympathetic, all about the money for the consultant. Does your private doctor guest still think his private patients are being treated as second-class citizens in a broken health system? That's from Paul.
I think they are now being treated as second-class citizens. But what has happened them to inform him is that those people who were due for half surgery have now gone on a public waiting list and they've gone to the back of it. And these are people, through no fault of their own, have had to take health insurance out because they couldn't get into the public system. As simple as that.
Okay, there's another text here. I'm waiting on a hysterectomy due to abnormal bleeding. The private consultant doesn't even have access to the lab for biopsies. He doesn't have access to a specialist theatre. What's the point in Simon Harris telling people to go to the GP? My GP can do nothing for me. And that's hashtag cancel the contract.
There's one other point here.
Briefly, and I want to bring in Sheila then.
What they did then was that if I was a private consultant, I was working pro bono, and I went into the public hospital and I did a procedure. They said, the state claim is not going to cover you. And then they said further, if you have a biopsy, the state claims agency won't cover you. And then they had to pull back on that because Stephen Donnelly, the Fianna Fáil spokesman, came on the programme and one of the programmes and lambasted that. And they pulled back on that. That's how bad it's got. That's not on. That's immoral.
Sheila Killian, what do you make of it?
I think, and I'm not an expert on health economics, but I think it certainly does seem to be the case that the private hospitals are being underused at the moment, and that the decision to take on the capacity was a good one at the time. And I think we need to be reasonably agile and see if we are committed to kind of owning, in inverted commas, the private hospitals, how we can use them to reduce the waiting lists that, as Michael says, private patients have gone to the back of and other patients have been waiting for a very long time on. Mm. If they're set up for the capacity, then maybe there's an opportunity here to clear some of the public waiting lists, public/private waiting lists, okay, which are unacceptably long.
Okay. I think general agreement on that there, so we can afford to move on. There is still a political scene going on, Christina, and indeed it's kind of hotting up now finally, and we think we could possibly see, I think, a programme for government by the end of the coming week, they're saying to us. What jumped out at you in the papers today about government formation?
Well, there's a lot in it about the Green Party, particularly with the leadership challenge happening there. And I think that the Business Post had an interesting piece from Aidan Corkery sort of delving into that a bit. I think
There are many different narratives about the Green leadership challenge, with, I think, different people seeing it through different prisms.
Lenses.
Owen Harris is looking at it mm-hmm. through the Greens should ditch the trots now and the reasonable part of the Greens go in. Justine McCarthy is looking at it through a lens of feminism and saying that
Catherine Martin would be a good leader. And I think exactly, I think the Business Post points that there didn't seem to be a big campaign around this. Now, I've heard from different views, as you said, from a different lens, that there was things happening in the background, perhaps a month before all of this came about, that the letter was put forward urging Catherine Martin, that there was some sort of movement between the members at grassroots level of getting her involved in that leadership challenge,
okay,
as such.
But there has been a narrative as well, if I can come to your narrative, that Catherine Martin had nothing to do with any of this, and
now
was
she
a
has
surprise
said that
as
she
anyone.
Will. She will consider it, you know, going forward, that she might be interested in the job. Speaking to a number of Green Party members, a lot of them were very disappointed, I think, at what's come about from this, in terms of the eye on the ball should be the programme for government talks. That this really does have a sideline narrative to it that they didn't really want to get involved with. And a lot of them saying that they kind of pride themselves, the Green Party, on not being like other political parties in terms of these sort of leadership heaves and all the rest. That, as one person said to me, if Catherine Martin was interested in the job, she probably could have gone and talked to Eamon Ryan about it and perhaps bashed it out.
That would be the
two
green
of them,
way. Like,
that would be the green way of doing things. And I think for this, it's a bit unpalatable for some people in the party, and disappointment is what a few people had said to me. What way it's going to play out in terms of whether Eamon or Catherine will take the helm of that, I think Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael would really like to know that answer, because they're sitting around that table and they would like to know, I suppose, who is going to be the leader of the party that perhaps might go in.
There's a great line, I think it's in the Business Post, about that this leadership battle actually could have been pushed out until August, but Eamon Ryan wanted to go on holidays at the end of June, so asked them to have it earlier. And that I don't know if that's true or
yeah,
not.
Yeah, we'll have to ask Abel that himself, I suppose.
Sheila, where do you think we're at with government formation? We definitely, I think it's generally agreed now we need a proper government, don't we?
Oh, for sure. But I think hard and all as it is to predict a pandemic, predicting what the government is going to be like at this point is even more complicated. One thing I find very interesting about the coverage of the Green Leadership Revolt, as it's always, it's always framed as like a leadership heave or a leadership revolt, is how many people outside the Green Party, and I myself am not a member of any political party, have a very strong view on who should be the leader. Whereas the people I know within the Green Party are looking with some bemusement at this, saying, well, of course we choose our leader, and we choose the leader not the one that you think might be, might slot most easily into government, but the one that represents our views. So I think there's a, an interesting kind of paradigm sort of clash there. Like, I know a lot of the people to the kind of the left of the Green Party, to put it crudely, would think, well, naturally we're going to choose the leader who represents us, not necessarily the leader who's going to fit in best with Leo and Michael.
OK, now it does seem as well, now it's emerging, that there's going to be independents involved as well as the Greens. Michael, where do you stand on this government formation?
Well, I think it's about time they got on with it and created a government. I think it has all the aspects of being very unstable when they're formed.
But is the, I gather the idea of bringing in some independents as well, is that will give it such a big majority,
a bit
that
more stability,
stable, yeah.
And if the Green, if some of these independents opt out, so obviously the Greens will still be there or whatever. But I must say, if I was Leo Varadkar, I'd be willing to play this along for a while longer, hoping that the, that as Anthony says, we'll eliminate the virus so that we'll be able to function. And they'll have an election of 36%. He's on course to make, almost make a majority.
Talk of an election in September. Have you, Christina?
Well, I have indeed, yeah. But how that would actually work, I have no idea, in the middle of a pandemic. But I think that was what the whole spat, or the storm in a teacup argument last week between Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael was about, was, you know, getting their backs up about the Department of Housing planning a general election. Some would say they could be rather remiss in not looking at contingency plans in terms of the way this is. I speak to some Fianna Fáil people that believe it's 50-50 whether the Greens would go in. Now, if they pull out at this stage, it really is a mess. And if you're trying to cobble together with a couple of independents, we see Simon Coveney has reached out to Verona Murphy. And, you know, if you look back at some of the headlines over the treatment of...
So Verona Murphy wasn't good enough for Fine Gael, but she's good enough to win to government with them now.
Exactly. You know, it's amazing how things can quickly change in politics when they have to. But there is another side that people are saying that the Green Party would be mad not to go in at this stage, because they probably might not get that opportunity
that
for some time to
moment.
Come. Yeah. But at the same time, before any of this happened, there was a lot of talk about green initiatives, and they do have a mention of it in the framework of about this new Green Deal and the 7% and all that. When we're talking, you're hearing the narrative coming out from Pascal Donoghue in terms of heading into one of the worst recessions the country's ever seen. And then you're also talking about the increase in taxes, carbon taxes and all the rest. It'll be interesting to see the dynamic of what programme for government might actually come out of all those talks.
Yeah, Sheila, there's two pieces in the Sunday Indo today on the same page by Shane Coleman and Jody Corcoran, both saying essentially that this will come straight in as the most unpopular, bitter, embittered already and divisive kind of government that we've seen in a long time. And Shane Coleman saying from the beginning there'll be huge animosity towards this government. And then they're coming into, aren't they, quite a difficult situation?
Coming into a really difficult and really unpredictable situation where they don't particularly trust each other. And because the political cohesion is so fragile, it wouldn't take much for any of them to trigger an election. So they're on a boat that any of them can sink at any one time. We're going into a recession that seems to be reasonably inevitable. It's very unpredictable when this will happen and how long it will last. And then there's the whole thing of like the World Health Organization predicting a second wave in, say, winter. So September is likely to be one of the best times because we'll have opened things up a little. Mm-hmm. People will have been back at work. You know, then the situation might be very good relatively to what is going to come into the future. So it's people are going to be looking back and analysing this in political history for a long time.
Yeah, and we're, of course, we're also going to have a situation where we're trying to fix a broken economy, but we're also going to have to spend tens of billions on green initiatives, and then Brexit coming down the track as well.
Well, I do think the point about perhaps Fine Gael wanted to push out to election, there is a big problem in terms of a lot of the business supports that we need to get on track for small and medium businesses, particularly during this crisis, need legislation. And they've been announced 2 or 3 weeks ago by Pascal Donoghue, by big fanfare of all this money that was going to flood into businesses to help them through this time. And that's just not happening as of yet because we don't have a government. We can't pass legislation that's needed for two of their main projects. We do have the tax rebate or the rebate rates from councils, but that's to a maximum of €10,000 for businesses.
Yeah,
and that's just not enough to make sure that we get those doors open. We're talking about, you know, maybe having a longer lockdown. Perhaps if people wanted to drag this out to see where the virus goes. But if we don't get cash flow and that legislation passed, we won't have businesses to open up after that lockdown.
Yeah,
that just won't
happen. And look, even at that, everyone who wants a bailout at this point just can't get a bailout. Anthony Staines, we talked there about events, if you will, how unpredictable politics can be. We've seen events happen in the UK in the last 24 hours. What do you make of the Dominic Cummings? I thought the extraordinary thing about it was that I've basically seen a load of Tory politicians, a handful of them certainly, come out and now start saying, well, you know, it's up to everybody to handle the lockdown for themselves. And look, if you have to break the rules a little, has one man undermined the whole lockdown over there?
Yeah, pretty much. And he may well have undermined his government, which would be probably a positive achievement for the British. But it does show that how governments can be blown around by unexpected events. But our governments have an opportunity to either blow before the winds now or to actually seize them. There's a bunch of things that they didn't do for a variety of reasons in the last government, health, housing and so on. If this government can demonstrate to the electorate that they're going to do stuff, they could do really, really well. They could hang together. If they don't...
Are they going to have the money to do stuff?
It depends where how you think you get money. There's lots of different ways of getting money, and governments can be very creative. And if you want to get money to do large scale capital stuff, there hasn't been a better time in the last 70 years.
And there's something as well as money that you need for that, and that's political support. And the one thing that has come out of this whole pandemic is a greater sense of social solidarity. We can see a lot of us...
For now.
There's a window. Like, for now, we can see that a lot of people who might have been reasonably self-important are not essential workers. I'm not an essential worker. Yeah. Whereas people working in Aldi and Lidl and cleaning hospitals at great risk to themselves are essential workers. So there is an opportunity, as Anthony says, for a government to kind of look at that and set about doing something real that would create a slightly more solid society. Like, because populism is out there like the virus. And we've, you know, it's been kind of nipping around the edges of the political scene, and we don't want that in our country.
Yeah. I want to go back to Dominic Cummings for a minute, though. I don't feel we've given this the air it deserves. Christina, what did you make of it? Has one man basically, like, he's dragged down a load of government ministers with him now, if he wasn't telling the truth? And the lockdown seems to be completely changed now as well.
Yeah, I think it was like Twitter was lighting up about it in terms of some of the Tories coming out to support him. And I do think there is some sort of denial coming from Downing Street about the second trip that apparently he made to Durham sightseeing or something like that.
I think the sightseeing was on the first trip. He went back up. He was basically commuting.
Yeah, and I thought the video was interesting with them telling to keep the photographers at social distancing to try and keep them away. But yeah, I think, you know, it's something that particularly the UK media will latch on to, that it could perhaps even just be a sideline to some of the mess, I think, that the UK government has in handled this whole thing.
Bear in mind, The Spectator has come out against him. Mm-hmm. That's essentially the soul of the Conservative Party. Alex Massey's piece in The Spectator is savage. And I haven't seen what Conservative Home Office
said. Okay, so he didn't do that without getting a nod from people, you think?
I suspect not. Yeah, no, yeah.
It's probably changing by the hour, no, but I'm sure we'll hear if he's gone at any stage over the course of the show. All right, listen, that flew, didn't it? So I want to say thank you very much to Anthony Staines and Michael O'Keefe and Sheila Killian. And you're all leaving us now. Christina Finn, will you stay with us for the next hour?
Indeed.
Okay, and let's take a break.
Text 51551. Brendan O'Connor on RTE Radio 1.